I have never promised anything about blood, tears, toil, and sweat.
This is a compression of words spoken by Winston Spencer Churchill, born in 1874. He will be 80 years old tomorrow. In his lifetime, he has studied history, reported it, written it, and on occasion prophesied it.
I have not always been wrong about the future of events, and if you will permit me, I shall inscribe some of these words as my testament, because I should like to be held accountable for them in years which I shall not see.
Mr. Churchill has changed hats many times, and political parties once. This is in 1909, when he was a liberal, and the conservatives were always wrong.
Their taxation will make food dearer. Our taxation will make land cheaper. That is our policy. That is the issue. Choose for yourself. Winston Churchill.
Mr. Churchill has always been a combination of history, action, and nostalgia.
For us in Britain, the 19th century ended amid the glories of the Victorian era. And we entered upon the dawn of the 20th in high hope for our country, our empire, and the world.
And his house, the House of Commons.
I'm a child of the House of Commons. I was brought up in my father's house to believe in democracy. Trust the people. That was his message. I used to see him cheered at meetings and in the streets by crowds of working men way back in those aristocratic Victorian days when, as Disraeli said, the world was for the few and for the very few.
Mr. Churchill's memory and experience encompasses the beginning and the end of two world wars. November 1918.
We have got a tremendous task before us, rushing upon us with all the speed of crisis. We have won the great war. Let us win the great field.
His opinion of men and issues was never ambiguous. From Al Smith to Bolshevism.
I had followed Al Smith's contest for the presidency with keen interest and sympathy. I was in the fullest agreement with his attitude on prohibition. I even suggested to him a slogan. All for Al, and Al for all. The failure to strangle Bolshevism at its birth and to bring Russia then prostrate by one means or another into the general democratic system lies heavy upon us today.
In 1934, from the political wilderness, without office and without power, Winston Churchill was one of the first to warn in solemn terms of the danger of Nazism.
For nearly 1,000 years, England has never seen the campfires of an invader. It is indeed with a pang of stabbing pain that we see all this in mortal danger. 1,000 years scarce serve to form a state. An hour may lay it in the dust. What shall we do?
November 16, 1934.
At present we lie within a few minutes striking distance of the French, Dutch, and Belgian coasts, and within a few hours of the great aerodromes of Central Europe. We are even within cannon shot of the continent. So close as that. Is it prudent? Is it possible, however we might desire it, to turn our backs upon Europe and ignore whatever may happen there? I hope. I pray, and on the whole, grasping the larger hope, I believe that no war will fall upon us. But if in the near future the Great War of 1914 is resumed again in Europe after the armistice. For that is what it may come to, under different conditions, no doubt, in differing combinations, no doubt. If that should happen, no one can tell where and how it would end, or whether sooner or later we should not be dragged into it. Dragged into it as the United States were dragged in against their will in 1917.
At the time of Munich in 1938, Mr. Churchill, still in the political wilderness, still without power, spoke of the power of a mouse.
You see these dictators on their pedestal, surrounded by the bayonets of their soldiers and the truncheons of their police. Yet in their hearts, there is unspoken, unspeakable fear. They are afraid of words and thoughts. Words spoken abroad, thoughts stirring at home, all the more powerful because forbidden. These terrify them. A little mouse, a little tiny mouse of thought appears in the room, and even the mightiest potentates are thrown into panic.
Instead of appeasement, Mr. Churchill wanted arms and more arms.
We must arm. Britain must arm. America must arm. Of course we shall do it in the end. We shall sure do it. But how much harder our toil for every day's delay. That is what I have to say to you on this occasion. And let me say, is this a call to war? Does anyone pretend that preparations for resistance against aggression amounts to the unleashing of war? There indeed is a sorry tale. I declare it to be the sole guarantee of peace.
November 12, 1939. The war was 7 weeks old. Poland had fallen. Britain's new First Lord of the Admiralty spoke of the gathering storm.
We tried again and again to prevent this war. And for the sake of peace, we put up with a lot of things happening which ought not to have happened. But now we are at war. And we are going to make war. And persevere in making war until the other side has had enough of it.
Still the autumn of 39, the Sitzkrieg, the phony war. Germany and Russia had carved up Poland, but Russia remained the big question mark.
I cannot forecast to you the action of Russia. It is a riddle wrapped in a mystery, inside an enigma. But perhaps there is a key. That key is Russian national interest.
The winter of 1940, those who sought security in neutrality were warned.
Each one hopes that if he feeds the crocodile enough, the crocodile will eat him last. All of them hope that the storm will pass before their turn comes to be devoured. But I fear greatly, the storm will not pass. It will rage and it will roar ever more loudly, ever more widely. It will spread to the south. It will spread to the north.
Mr. Churchill admired the lack of neutrality on the Mannerheim line.
Only Finland, superb, nay, sublime. Sublime in the jaws of peril. Finland shows what free men can do. The service rendered by Finland to mankind is magnificent. They have exposed for all the world to see the military incapacity of the Red Army and of the Red Air Force. Many illusions about Soviet Russia have been dispelled in these few fierce weeks of fighting in the Arctic Circle. Everyone can see how communism rots the soul of a nation, how it makes it abject and hungry in peace, and proves it base and abominable in war.
May 10, 1940. The Germans had struck for victory in the West. The storm broke over France, the Low Countries, Denmark, and Norway. And in London, the House of Commons wrenched power from Neville Chamberlain, and there was no one to turn to but Winston Churchill.
It was clear that at this critical moment in the war, what was needed was the formation of a government which would include members of the Labour and Liberal oppositions. His Majesty has now entrusted to my friend and colleague, Mr. Winston Churchill, the task of forming a new administration on a national basis.
I speak to you for the first time as Prime Minister in a solemn hour for the life of our country, of our empire, of our allies, and above all, of the cause of freedom. A tremendous battle is raging in France and Flanders. The Germans, by a remarkable combination of air bombing and heavily armored tanks, have broken through the French defenses north of the Maginot Line, and strong columns of their armored vehicles are ravaging the open country, which for the first day or two was without defenders. We have differed and quarreled in the past, but now one bond unites us all: to wage war until victory is won, and never to surrender ourselves to servitude and shame, whatever the cost and the agony may be. If this is one of the most awe-striking periods in the long history of France and Britain, it is also, beyond doubt, the most sublime. Behind them, behind us, behind the armies and fleets of Britain and France, gather a group of shattered states and bludgeoned races: the Czechs, the Poles, the Norwegians, the Danes, the Dutch, the Belgians, upon all of whom the long night of barbarism will descend, unbroken even by a star of hope, unless we conquer. As conquer we must, as conquer we shall.
On May 13, 1940, he said it for the first time.
I have never promised anything but blood, tears, toil, and sweat.
And his voice reached out across the channel to hearten the beaten French.
Français, c'est moi, Churchill, qui vous parle. Allons. Bonne nuit. Dormez bien. Rassemblez vos forces pour l'aube, car l'aube viendra. Elle se lèvera brillante pour les braves, douce pour les fidèles qui auront souffert, glorieuse sur les tombeaux des héros. Vive la France!
And then in June of 40, Britain stood alone. And most men, save Englishmen, despaired of Britain's life. The little ships, helped by calm seas and high courage, had worked their miracle at Dunkirk, but most of the guns and armor had been left behind. Mr. Churchill charted the course for his island race.
What General Vagon has called the Battle of France is over. The Battle of Britain is about to begin. Upon this battle depends the survival of Christian civilization. Upon it depends our own British life and the long continuity of our institutions and our empire. The whole fury and might of the enemy must very soon be turned on us. Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be freed, and the life of the world may move forward into broad, sunlit uplands. But if we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, including all that we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age, made more sinister and perhaps more protracted by the lights of perverted science. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty.
and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
July 40. The children were in the country. Men drilled with shotguns. The church bells were silent, to be sounded only to signal a German invasion.
And now it has come to us to stand alone in the breach and face the worst that the tyrant's might and enmity can do. Should the invader come to Britain, there will be no placid lying down of the people in submission before him, as we have seen, alas, in other countries. We shall defend every village, every town, and every city. The vast mass of London itself, fought street by street, could easily devour an entire hostile army. And we would rather see London laid in ruins and ashes than that it should be tamely and abjectly enslaved.
The siege was to remain for 3 years.
And if the Nazi villains drop down upon us from the skies, any night, in raid or heavy attack upon the key production centers, you will make it clear to them that they have not alighted in the poultry run, or in the rabbit farm, or even in the sheepfold, but that they have come down in the lion's den at the zoo.
For Mr. Churchill, this was not merely a war for survival.
We seek to beat the life and soul out of Hitler and Hitlerism. That alone, that all the time, that to the end.
In September 1940, the bombers came at dusk and left at dawn, and the Germans were expected on the beaches the first foggy morning.
We must regard the next week or so as a very important week for us in our history. It ranks with the days when the Spanish Armada was approaching the Channel and Drake was finishing his game of bowls, or when Nelson stood between us and Napoleon's Grand Army at Boulogne.
Unable to live in the daylight, the Germans struck in the night.
These cruel, wanton, indiscriminate bombings of London are, of course, a part of Hitler's invasion plan. Little does he know the spirit of the British nation, or the tough fiber of the Londoners. This wicked man, the repository and embodiment of many forms of soul-destroying hatreds, this monstrous product of former wrongs and shame, has now resolved to try to break our famous island race by a process of indiscriminate slaughter and destruction. What he has done is to kindle a fire in British hearts, here and all over the world, which will glow long after all traces of the conflagrations he has caused in London have been removed. He has lighted a fire which will burn with a steady and consuming flame until the last vestiges of Nazi tyranny have been burnt out of Europe, and until the old world and the new can join hands to rebuild the temples of man's freedom and man's honor upon foundations which will not soon or easily be overthrown.
In all, the Battle of Britain lasted less than 5 weeks.
In order to win the war, Hitler must destroy Great Britain. He may carry havoc into the Balkan states. He may tear great provinces out of Russia. He may march to the Caspian. He may march to the gates of India. All this will avail him nothing. And all the time, masters of the sea and air, the British Empire, nay, in a certain sense, the whole English-speaking world, will be on his track,
bearing with them the swords of justice.
The historian records the victory.
In July, August, and September, 40 or 50 squadrons of British fighter aircraft in the Battle of Britain broke the teeth of the German air fleet at odds of 7 or 8 to 1. Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few.
February 41. A former naval person acknowledges a letter.
The other day, President Roosevelt gave his opponent in the late presidential election a letter of introduction to me. And in it he wrote out a verse in his own handwriting from Longfellow, which he said applies to you people as it does to us. Here is the verse. Sail on, O ship of state. Sail on, O Union, strong and great. Humanity with all its fears, with all the hopes of future years, is hanging breathless on thy fate. What is the answer that I shall give in your name to this great man, the thrice chosen head of a nation of 130 millions? Here is the answer which I will give to President Roosevelt. Put your confidence in us. Give us your faith and your blessing. And under Providence, all will be well. We shall not fail or falter. We shall not weaken or tire. Neither the sudden shock of battle nor the long-drawn trials of vigilance and exertion will wear us down. Give us the tools, and we will finish the job.
Occasionally, Mr. Churchill tempered his military judgment with political expediency. And the winter of 41 was a time for expediency.
We do not need the gallant armies which are forming throughout the American Union. We do not need them this year, nor next year, nor any year that I can foresee. But we do need, most urgently, an immense and continuous supply of war materials and technical apparatus of all kinds. We need them here, and we need to bring them here.
The historian examines the motives of the United States.
Never again let us hear the taunt that money is the ruling thought or power in the heart of the American democracy. The Lend-Lease Bill must be regarded without question as the most unsordid act in the whole of recorded history.
The gallant Greeks stopped Mussolini's legions. He had to ask Hitler's help, and Churchill made this comment.
Here, surely, is the world's record in the domain of the ridiculous and the contemptible. This whipped jackal Mussolini, who to save his own skin has made all Italy a vassal state of Hitler's empire, comes frisking up at the side of the German tiger with yelpings not only of appetite, that could be understood, but even of triumph.
He could not see the end of the road, but he knew where it led.
But one thing is certain. One thing is sure. It will not be by German hands that the structure of Europe will be rebuilt or the union of the European family achieved. We cannot yet see how deliverance will come or when it will come. But nothing is more certain than that every trace of Hitler's footsteps, every stain of his infected and corroding fingers will be sponged and purged and, if need be, blasted from the surface of the earth.
June 16, 1941. Britain still stood alone.
Now
The old lion, with her lion cubs at her side, stands alone against hunters who are armed with deadly weapons and impelled by desperate and destructive rage. Is the tragedy to repeat itself once more? Ah, no. This is not the end of the tale. The stars in their courses proclaim the deliverance of mankind. But time is short. Every month that passes adds to the length and to the perils of the journey that will have to be made. United we stand, divided we fall. Divided, the dark ages return. United, we can save and guide the world.
6 days later, an announcement from Downing Street.
At 4 o'clock this morning, Hitler attacked and invaded Russia. So now this bloodthirsty gutter snipe must launch his mechanized armies upon new fields of slaughter, pillage, and devastation.
Part of the riddle had been solved.
Can you doubt what our policy will be? We have but one aim and one single irrevocable purpose. We are resolved to destroy Hitler and every vestige of the Nazi regime. From this, nothing will turn us. Nothing. We will never parley. We will never negotiate with Hitler or any of his gang. We shall fight him by land. We shall fight him by sea. We shall fight him in the air until, with God's help, we have rid the earth of his shadow and liberated its peoples from his yoke. Any man or state who fights against Nazism will have our aid. Any man or state who marches with Hitler is our foe. That is our policy, and that is our declaration. It follows, therefore, that we shall give whatever help we can to Russia and to the Russian people.
The Germans eased up on the bombing, but the Prime Minister asked no quarter.
We ask no favors of the enemy.
On the contrary, if tonight the people of London were asked to cast their vote as to whether a convention should be entered into to stop the bombing of all cities, an overwhelming majority would cry, no, we will mete out to the Germans the measure and more than the measure they have meted out to us. We will have no truce or parley with you or the grisly gang who work your wicked will. You do your worst, and we will do our best.
August 41. Britain's principal export was hope and faith, hammered out in the words of Winston Churchill.
Do not despair, brave Norwegians. Your land shall be cleansed, not only from the invader, but from the filthy quislings who are his tools. Be sure of yourselves, Czechs. Your independence shall be restored. Poles, the heroism of your people, standing up to cruel oppressors, the courage of your soldiers, sailors, and airmen shall not be forgotten. Your country shall live again and resume its rightful part in the new organization of Europe. Lift up your heads, gallant Frenchmen. Not all the infamies of Darlan and of Laval shall stand between you and the restoration of your birthright. Tough, stout-hearted Dutch, Belgians, Luxembourgers, tormented, mishandled, shamefully cast away peoples of Yugoslavia, glorious Greece, now subjected to the crowning insult of the rule of the Italian jackanapes, yield not an inch. Keep your souls clean from all contact with the Nazi. Make them feel, even in their fleeting hour of brutish triumph, that they are the moral outcasts of mankind. Help is coming. Mighty forces are arming in your behalf. Have faith, have hope. Deliverance is sure.
1 month before Pearl Harbor.
I take this occasion to say, and it is my duty to say, that should the United States become involved in war with Japan, the British declaration will follow within the hour.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
The same day in London.
The cabinet, which met at 12:30 today, authorized an immediate declaration of war upon Japan.
Mr. Churchill spent Christmas of 41 at the White House, spoke to a joint session of Congress.
They have certainly embarked upon a very considerable undertaking. After the outrages they have committed upon us at Pearl Harbor, in the Pacific Islands, in the Philippines, in Malaya and the Dutch East Indies, they must now know that the stakes for which they have decided to play are mortal. What kind of a people do they think we are? Is it possible they do not realize that we shall never cease to persevere against them until they have been taught a lesson which they and the world will never forget? By the way, I cannot help reflecting that if my father had been American and my mother British, instead of the other way around, I might have got here on my own.
On the way back to London, he told the Canadian Parliament a little recent French history.
When I warned them that Britain would fight on alone, whatever they did, their generals told their prime minister and his divided cabinet, in 3 weeks, England will have her neck wrung like a chicken. Some chicken. Some neck.
And later, in England, he told how the defeated French generals had asked him how he proposed to defend the island.
So I said that, of course, I was not a military expert, and I was always very careful in not meddling in those sort of questions, but that my professional advisers told me that the best way to deal with such an invasion would be to drown as many as possible on the way over and knock the others on the head as they crawled ashore. The unfortunate general replied, I must admit that at any rate you have a very good anti-tank obstacle.
Autumn 1942. American troops were in England. The Germans were at the gates of Stalingrad. Rommel was pulling back at El Alamein. And Mr. Churchill was at the Kremlin.
When I was leaving the Kremlin in the middle of August, I said to Premier Stalin, when we have decisively defeated Rommel in Egypt, I will send you a telegram. And he replied, when we make our counteroffensive here, and he drew the arrow on the map, I will send you one. Both messages have duly arrived, and both have been thankfully received.
On November 10, Mr. Churchill sent his message.
General Alexander, with his brilliant comrade and lieutenant, General Montgomery, has gained a glorious and decisive victory in what I think should be called the Battle of Egypt. Rommel's army has been defeated.
On November 29, Mr. Churchill heard from Stalin.
The jaws of another Russian winter are closing on Hitler's armies. 180 German divisions many of them reduced to little more than brigades by the slaughters and privations they have suffered. They have, of course, the consolation of knowing that they have been commanded and led not by the German General Staff, but by Corporal Hitler himself.
A new phase was beginning.
Ah, this is not the end. It is not even the beginning of the end. But it is perhaps the end of the beginning.
Mr. Churchill is half American, but all 19th century English.
Let me, however, make this clear, in case there should be any mistake about it in any quarter. We mean to hold our own. I have not become the King's first minister in order to preside over the liquidation of the British Empire.
In May of 43, Mr. Churchill stood before Congress again with the first good news since the war began.
Mr. President, the African war is over. One continent, at least, has been cleansed and purged forever from fascist or Nazi tyranny. The proud German army has by its sudden collapse, its sudden crumpling and breaking up, unexpected to all of us, the proud German army has once again proved the truth of the saying, the Hun is always either at your throat or your feet.
And Mr. Churchill asked for more help for Russia.
Not for one moment must we forget that the main burden of the war on land is still being borne by the Russian army. But there is little doubt that Hitler is reserving his supreme gambler's throw for a third attempt to break the heart and spirit and destroy the armed forces of the mighty nation which he has already twice assaulted in vain. He will not succeed. But we must do everything in our power that is sensible and practicable to take more of the weight off Russia in 1943.
The Big Three agreed on no compromise.
We, the United Nations, demand from the Nazi, fascist, and Japanese tyrannies unconditional surrender.
The Russians continued to press for a second front.
We have heard a lot of talk in the last 2 years about establishing what is called a second front in northern France against Germany. It is quite natural that the Russians, bearing the main weight of the German armies on their front, should urge us ceaselessly to undertake this task and should in no way conceal their complaints and even reproaches that we have not done it before. I look forward to the day when British and American liberating armies will cross the Channel in full force and come to close quarters with the German invaders of France. You would certainly not wish me to tell you when that is likely to happen, or whether it be near or far.
Whether defending or attacking, Mr. Churchill never attempted to conceal the cost. He warned what D-Day would mean.
It is a reasonable assumption that unless we make some grave mistake in strategy, the year 1944 will see the climax of the European war. 1944 will see the greatest sacrifice of life by the British and American armies. Battles far larger and more costly than Waterloo or Gettysburg will be fought. Sorrow will come to many homes in the United Kingdom and throughout the Great Republic. British and American manhood, striving in generous emulation, true brothers in arms, will attack and grapple with the deadly foe.
The cross-channel assault was mounted. The ring was ready to close.
Since I spoke to you last, Not only have the Hun invaders been driven from the lands they had ravaged, but the guts of the German army have been largely torn out by Russian valor and generalship. The American victories in the Pacific, and in particular their latest conquest and liberation of the Marshall Islands, constitute superb examples of the combination of naval, air, and military force. It is possible that the war in the Pacific may progress more rapidly than was formerly thought possible. The hour of our greatest effort and action is approaching. And when the signal is given, the whole circle of avenging nations will hurl themselves upon the foe and batter out the life of the cruelest tyranny which has ever sought to bar the progress of mankind.
June 6, 1944.
People of Western Europe, a landing was made this morning on the coast of France by troops of the Allied Expeditionary Force. This landing is part of the concerted United Nations plan for the liberation of Europe, made in conjunction with our great Russian allies.
Mr. Churchill was never willing to forget what made D-Day possible.
It will ever be the glory of this island and its empire that we stood alone for one whole year of mortal peril and gained the time for the good cause to arm, to organize, and slowly bring the conjoined, united, irresistible forces of outraged civilization to bear upon the criminals. That is our greatest glory.
A comment on the last meeting between Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin.
The agreement which was made at Yalta, to which I was a party, was extremely favorable to Soviet Russia. But it was made at a time when no one could say that the German war might not extend all through the summer and autumn of 1945, and when the Japanese war was expected, by the best judges, to last for a further 18 months from the end of the German war.
April 12, 1945. The president is dead.
He was the greatest American friend that Britain ever found.
April 20, 1945. The link-up on the Elbe.
After long journeys, toils, and victories across the lands and oceans, across so many deadly battlefields, the armies of the great Allies have traversed Germany and have joined hands together.
May 8, 1945.
Yesterday morning at 2:41 a.m. at General Eisenhower's headquarters, General Jodl signed the act of unconditional surrender of all German land, sea, and air forces in Europe to the Allied Expeditionary Force and simultaneously to the Soviet High Command. The German war is therefore at an end. But let us not forget for a moment the toils and efforts that lie ahead. Japan, with all her treachery and greed, remains unsubdued. Advance Britannia! Long live the cause of freedom. God save the king.
After victory, a return to domestic politics.
I wish I could tell you tonight that all our toils and troubles were over. Then indeed I could end my 5 years' service happily. And if you thought you had had enough of me and that I ought to be put out to grass, I assure you I would take it with the best of grace.
After 5 years of war, with all of Britain's enemies defeated, the British public, in his own words, decided that they had had enough of him and removed him from all active participation in the conduct of their affairs. Now, the man who had made so much history devoted his time to the writing of it.
Writing a book is an adventure. To begin with, it is a toy and an amusement, and then it becomes a mistress, and then it becomes a master, and then it becomes a tyrant, and the last phase is that just as you are about to be reconciled to your servitude, you kill the monster and fling him about to the public.
March 46. The man who had not always been wrong shared a platform at Fulton, Missouri, with President Truman.
Last time, I saw it all coming, and I cried aloud to my own fellow countrymen and to the world, but no one paid any attention.
And not for the first time, he created a new phrase.
From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent. Behind that line lie all the capitals of the ancient states of Central and Eastern Europe. Warsaw, Berlin, Prague, Vienna, Budapest, Belgrade, Bucharest, and Sofia. All these famous cities and the populations around them lie in what I must call the Soviet sphere. What is needed is a settlement. And the longer this is delayed, the more difficult it will be, and the greater our dangers will become. From what I have seen of our Russian friends and allies during the war, I am convinced that there is nothing they admire so much as strength. And there is nothing for which they have less respect than for weakness, especially military weakness.
In Zurich, that same summer, another forward look.
We must build a kind of United States of Europe.
But I must give you a warning. Time may be short. If we are to form the United States of Europe, or whatever name it may take, we must begin now.
I'm now going to say something that will astonish you. The first step in the recreation of the European family must be a partnership between France and Germany.
March 31, 1949. Back in the United States again.
I must not conceal from you tonight the truth as I see it. It is certain that Europe would have been communized like Czechoslovakia and London under bombardment some time ago, but for the deterrent of the atomic bomb in the hands of the United States. The situation has been well described by distinguished Americans as the Cold War. And the question is asked, are we winning the Cold War? We seek nothing from Russia but goodwill and fair play. If, however, there is to be a war of nerves, let us make sure that our nerves are strong.
A year later in Edinburgh, Mr. Churchill, still out of office, and still not without hope.
At Edinburgh, the other night, I said, I cannot help coming back to this idea of another talk with Soviet Russia upon the highest level. It is only by the agreement of the greatest powers that security can be given to ordinary folk against an annihilating war with atomic or hydrogen bombs or bacteriological horrors. I cannot find it in my heart and conscience to close the door upon that hope.
1950, the man of action, still willing and eager to take up the heavy burdens of office.
Of course, I am, as I am reminded, an old man. It is true that all the daydreams of my youth have been accomplished. I have no personal advantage to gain by undertaking once more the hard and grim duty of leading Britain and her empire through and out of her new and formidable crisis. But while God gives me the strength and the people show me their goodwill, it is my duty to try, and try I will.
In 1950, he lost the election to Mr. Attlee, but in October of 51, he tried again.
I pray indeed that I may have this opportunity. It is the last prize I seek to win.
The prize was his. On February 7, 1952, the man who had served six sovereigns speaks of his friend.
During these last months, the king walked with death, as if death were a companion, an acquaintance whom he recognized and did not fear. In the end, death came as a friend. And after a happy day of sunshine and sport, and after good night to those who loved him best, he fell asleep. As every man or woman who strives to fear God and nothing else in the world may hope to do. I, whose youth was passed in the august, unchallenged, and tranquil glories of the Victorian era, may well feel a thrill in invoking once more the prayer and the anthem, God Save the Queen.
Washington, D.C., June 54. The anti-communist, anti-compromise, anti-appeasement man of war continues his pursuit of peace.
I am of opinion that we ought to have a try for peaceful coexistence. You may someday hear that I've done something or other which looks as if I were going to become a communist. Well, I assure you that I've been all my life one of the really prominent people fighting this. If I had been properly supported in 1919, I think we might have strangled Bolshevism in its cradle. But everybody turned up their hands and said, oh, how shocking. And and I even remember for making a speech at Fulton from 6 years ago, which I didn't get a very warm welcome in the United States because it was so anti-Russian and anti-communist. But I am not anti-Russian. I am violently anti-communist. But I do beg you to make sure that no stone is left unturned in this period that to give them a chance to grasp the prospects of great material well-being which will be offered to all those millions. And I'm rather inclined to think that if I had to make a prediction that they will not throw away such an opportunity.
October 54. The London Agreement, providing unified defense for Western Europe. For Sir Winston Churchill, a source of hope.
I profoundly believe that this agreement may well become a monument and a milestone in our march towards that peaceful coexistence which is our heart's desire and during which the lasting peace for the world may find its sure foundation.
But the hope is conditional.
There is already in the United States
no little talk of a return to isolation, and the policy is described as Fortress America. For America to withdraw into isolation would condemn all Europe to Russian communist subjugation and our famous and beloved island to death and ruin.
This has been a compression of certain words spoken by Sir Winston Churchill, born in 1874. He will be 80 years old tomorrow.
Let all of us who are here remember that we are on the stage of history, and that whatever our station may be, whatever part we have to play, great or small, our conduct is liable to be scrutinized not only by history, but by our own descendants.
Good night, and good luck to you all.